Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. After the accident at Three Mile Island nuclear reactor in 1979, it looked like the nuclear industry's halcyon days were over. The Chernobyl and Fukushima disasters drove home even more starkly just how dangerous nuclear power is. But in recent years, there's been a growing drumbeat promoting nuclear power as a green carbon-neutral energy source. Yet despite the hype, nuclear power plants are still dangerous, dirty, and very expensive to build. Today we talk with Catherine Chutty with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation about how to counter the latest drive to restart the nuclear power engine. Catherine, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning.
It's actually a pleasure after seeing your name on so many listservs and so many Facebook posts and everything else fighting for economic and social and environmental justice here in the Northwest to actually have you on the show. So again, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet and see you and be on the show because I listen to it quite frequently and you cover a lot of important issues.
Well, thanks. Most of the work that I'm familiar with that you've been doing has to do with fighting the fossil fuel industry. So I'm kind of curious how you cropped up in this movement that's trying to raise awareness about the dangers of the resurgence of the nuclear power industry. So kind of wondering how you made that transition or if it's been kind of a bifurcated path over all these years.
Well, it's actually not a transition. It's more, I came out to Oregon in 1977, and I, at that time, began working at the Oregon State Hospital with teenagers who were suicidal, and I linked up in 1979 with Peter Burgell and Chuck Johnson, who were working on a ballot measure that would keep nuclear power plants from being built unless there was a federal repository
for all the nuclear waste.
Yeah. And a statewide vote of the people. And so at that time, I was concerned about nuclear power, and I was aware that there was a strong environmental activist community that was working toward shutting down the Trojan nuclear power plant and also raising awareness about how risky it was for our community and also how risky it was for our planet. So that's how I brought the concern with me and managed to connect with a group in Salem that was successful at that point in getting on the ballot. I knew that there had been multiple measures prior to that had failed, and this one managed to get on the ballot.
Well, back in 1977, which is actually before the Trojan nuclear power plant actually opened, this is out in Rainier, and for those of you who moved to Oregon in the last 10 years, you probably aren't even aware that it's there, but there used to be this big cooling tower that you could see as you were, you could see it best, actually both from Highway 30 as you're going towards Klatskanai, but also on the Washington side going up I-5, and just as you come to Kalama, you'd see this big cooling tower, and they imploded it, I think for PR reasons more than for any kind of safety reasons, because the danger of the Trojan nuclear power plant was not that cooling tower, but it's what's still there, which is the fuel rods that I guess are still in big pools of water, and the core. And ironically, I learned this a couple years ago when I was working on stories about the Kalama methanol refinery that was being proposed at that time, which was only defeated just a little less than a year ago, that I took a boat ride in the Columbia, and we could see what was there of Trojan, and it's exactly across the river from where the methanol refinery was going to be built. And in a way, I like to think about, throw that out, as the link between these two struggles, between stopping nuclear power and stopping fossil fuel development.
They're definitely linked. As far as being part of industries that have a tremendous ability to reach out and do a lot of persuasion that what they're offering is the right thing for us to do, and it's really the wrong thing for our public health, for our future, for the future of our children, to continue to dig deeper with fossil fuels and to risk the extreme toxic legacy of nuclear waste.
Well, I want to talk about the aftermath of, well, first of all, Three Mile Island, the infamous nuclear near disaster, which actually in some ways was a disaster, in Pennsylvania back in 1979. followed by the ballot measure that was succeeded in 1980 in Oregon that basically banned the construction of any new nuclear power plants until there was adequate and actual federal waste repository to put all the waste. And talk about how the nuclear industry seemed to be on its last legs, and in fact, it seems to just have withered away in the early 80s. So let's talk about why that was, and then what was actually going on subterraneously that we weren't aware of.
As far as Three Mile Island concerned, there had been no major disaster on American soil, although there had been plenty of near misses and lots of safety issues, along with all of the things that come along with the nuclear fuel cycle that are harmful and damaging.
Actually, wasn't there an accident in England, the Windscale, in 1957?
True, but I'm talking about in the United States. And when Three Mile Island happened, it was an amazing conjunction with what was happening in Oregon, because Peter Burgell and Chuck Johnson had initially attempted a statute through the legislature, and they had proposed legislation in the House on the very day there was going to be a vote, and it was the very day that Three Mile Island occurred. And Chuck Johnson told me that he remembered leaving for lunch and coming back, and after the news hit about Three Mile Island, they got a vote of 44 representatives at the time to vote for the statute. But however, it ended up not passing the full legislative body. And so the awareness that came with that accident happening propelled our initiative into law for Oregon in 1980 when it was
passed by the voters.
Yes, it was passed.
Actually, the other interesting coincidence was that the Three Mile Island accident happened, what was it, like 12 days after the movie The China Syndrome had been released?
Yes.
But it was an interesting coincidence. And in fact, there were many similarities. There was a film that was being shown on, I think it was Netflix recently, probably still on, called Meltdown. And it's the story of Three Mile Island. And it was interesting to watch that movie a couple weeks ago and to remember how many similarities there were between the accident that they portray in the China Syndrome and what happened in Three Mile Island. And I wonder how that prescience really helped to make people across the country justifiably scared about nuclear power and its proliferation.
Well, I think it did, but at the same time, what occurred there and what we saw in this latest film was how the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to oversee when these kinds of things happen, and the kind of national governmental approval and push for the nuclear industry, was aware that this could be a huge threat to the nuclear industry. And so when it came to what decisions they made around evacuating people, letting them know what was going on public health-wise, what the risks and dangers were, it's clear that the NRC oversight was more concerned about the industry surviving than people surviving. And I actually have a friend in Vancouver who lived there at the time, and she called the public health, and they said, there's nothing, no problem, don't worry about it, but if you want to, you could call the plant itself. And she thought, whoa, that's an interesting possibility. Okay, I'll call, but if they don't answer, it means something's going on and they can't answer, and so things are really, we're really in trouble. Or if they answer, it could mean the same thing, like they don't know what they're doing and they don't realize how serious this is. And as it turned out later, they were, as we saw in the film, they were 30 minutes from a meltdown. And in later investigations and figuring out what had happened, safety issues had preceded the building of the plant, and there was a cover-up on that, and the very valve that failed had almost failed in another plant in another part of the country, and people's lives were at stake, and yet those things were not addressed, and we came really close to a much worse thing happening.
Actually, I think I saw in the film, and I remember that it was about a year after the accident that it came out that, in fact, there had been a meltdown. It wasn't a meltdown that went all the way to China, but it was something that was very serious, and it was an indication of just how much even more serious it could have been.
Right, exactly. And the cleanup as well when the nuclear engineer who believes in nuclear power was involved in the cleanup, and he had to actually become a whistleblower to stop the cleanup team and the NRC from approving the use of a crane that had been damaged during the accident, and had it failed while they were doing the really critical portion of the cleanup, it would have and could have. And because of his testimony and because of what they were able to figure out, the NRC overruled. But the person who was on site, his name is Lake Barrett, and he's in the film. He talks about how he really didn't think any of that was a problem. He thought that Rick Parks was not right about his assessment. And what we also saw during that film was how he described the people in the community who were concerned as emotional and dismissed their fears. And I think one of the takeaways from that film applies to everything that's happened with the nuclear power industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that drive to continue keeping the industry going. And actually, people don't matter in that equation. It's what's going to be good for keeping the industry going.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Chetty, who's with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation, about how to counter the latest drive to restart the nuclear power engine. Well, after Three Mile Island, there were actually two more incredibly horrible nuclear catastrophes. Mm-hmm. One not that long ago. I mean, the first one after that was Chernobyl in 1986. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a whole part on the part of the American nuclear industry to say, well, our reactors aren't like Chernobyl. However, I think there's some issues about that. And then, of course, Fukushima as a result of the tsunami in Japan in 2011. And it seemed like each time, particularly after Fukushima, the nuclear industry just even shut down more. I guess Germany decided to close down all their nuclear power plants, and they have a larger part of the nation's power was supplied by nuclear in Germany than it is compared to the United States. But it seemed like while that's going on, in the meantime, there is this undercurrent of the nuclear power industry trying to promote itself in this brave new world of climate chaos as a green alternative. So let's talk about what is afoot there and how the nuclear power industry is trying to downplay, as they did, as you're describing, how the Nuclear Regulatory Commission downplayed Three Mile Island's dangers during the accident and in the cleanup, how they're continuing to do that as they are promoting nuclear power now. As Eric DuPlay said last week on the show, the latest shiny object.
Yes. Decades ago, when nuclear power was shifted from atomic explosions that led to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the nuclear power industry shifted to atoms for peace. This is a good thing. And economically, your electricity is going to be too cheap to meter once we do nuclear power and get it up and running. And so packaging it as something that would help people financially and economically. So the industry is very good at figuring out ways to package itself and sell itself. And so given that the economics of it have failed so drastically and safety has been a major concern, it fell into place for them to take a look at what happens at the generating site, which is no carbon emissions at the site where it's generated, and recognize that within the last several decades, people have progressively become more and more aware of and concerned about the catastrophic climate issues that we're facing. And so light bulbs, of course, went off in the marketing parts of the nuclear industry to say, wait, we can fit ourselves in here. We can get people to overlook the economic problems and the safety issues and the long-term waste issues. And we can present ourselves as a what in some places it's been called carbon free, some places carbon neutral, or non-emitting, simply because they're ignoring and getting other people to ignore the entire fuel cycle, which starts with the uranium mining, which is terribly devastating to all of the indigenous people that have been affected, all of the communities that have lived with the toxic legacy of that fuel being mined, and then the transporting of the fuel, the decommissioning of the plants, there's so much. It's very carbon intensive. However, the marketing says we're carbon neutral, and that's what the world wants.
Kind of reminds me of what the natural gas industry is doing, claiming that they're so have such low emissions compared to the coal.
Right,
but exactly. They claim basically that they're low emission, and there's all these leaks that they're not talking about in entire supply chain for producing it. It seems that energy industry in general, whether it's fossil fuel or nuclear, is really great at segmenting things, and so
yes.
You only look at the small piece of it. But I want to look at some people. I want to actually talk about three people that concern me who have been nuclear proponents. And the first one was Jim Hansen, who really led the charge on taking climate change seriously and has really great data, really great information. He's been really outspoken about the dangers of fossil fuel. But he turns out to be a nuclear advocate. And Al Gore, the same way. And then finally, Bill Gates. And I'm not sure what his motivations are. But let's start with Jim Hansen. Do you have any understanding why Jim Hansen is seeing nuclear power as an answer to fossil fuel?
The only thing I can think of is he compartmentalizes it the way a lot of other people do, and he's not a nuclear expert. He does have a lot of good things to say and valuable things and important things to say in sounding the alarm about catastrophic climate change, but it seems like he's not paying attention to, and he's also dismissing the voices that have been tracking and following and understanding the issue for so many decades. He was a keynote speaker at the law conference, I believe, several years ago in Eugene. And when someone stood up to challenge his advocacy, he dismissed, this was Lloyd Marbett at the time, he dismissed Lloyd as, he was really very quite rude. And what was interesting is that when he started being in Congress and talking about catastrophic climate change, he was treated that dismissively. People, and he didn't seem to get that he was doing the very same thing to people who knew what they were talking about and had something quite relevant to say. It's like he's closed his mind to that reality and is only looking at one part of it.
Now, what about Al Gore? How do you explain his...
I don't. I wish I did. I think part of the answer has to do with the persuasiveness of the nuclear industry, the nuclear lobby. They have tremendous amount of dollars. They're all about how they fund politicians and how they fund the people that take a pro-nuclear position. So it's not just people who represent us, it's also people who are out in the community. Right now our Department of Energy is funding a group called Good Energy Collective, and they're giving grants to go into communities to engage with environmental justice and parts of the community that would normally be backing away from nuclear power, and providing some funding to raise community awareness. And they're not honest, but at the bottom of their website it says they're a nuclear power, pro-nuclear. That's their agenda, is to persuade people to, and they're using the clean energy concerns that people have, the catastrophic climate change concerns that people have, as a vehicle for that persuasion.
Well, the third guy who's in my concern, which is Bill Gates, now he's actually, I think, the only one of the three that would actually make money off of it. And it's actually putting money into it. So let's talk a little bit about Bill Gates' nuclear program.
So I believe his is the Natrium proposal in Wyoming, which is interesting in relation to Oregon, because going back to the 1980 statute that was put into place that's protected us for for more than four decades now from nuclear power plants being sited in Oregon. It does not preclude our utilities from getting nuclear energy from plants that are not in Oregon. So Pacific Power right now has in their long-term resource plan a buy-in to the Natrium project in Wyoming. So the people in Wyoming would have the safety risks and everything that comes along with having a unproven, untested, not up and running technology as part of their electricity, and the people in Oregon wouldn't be having those same physical risks. So, you know, I think that's a problem.
So you're saying that people in Oregon might have the physical risk, but however, they would perhaps suffer the same financial risks. And we can look back a few decades to the Washington Public Power Supply System,
yes,
otherwise known affectionately as WPS. They've changed their name since then.
Yes.
And they were going to build five reactors.
Yes.
There's two that got built and one that actually is in operation on the Hanford Reservation in east central Washington. But let's talk a bit about the financial windfall. Well, not the windfall, but the financial windstorm that resulted from the WPS projects.
Well, ratepayers are still paying for that. And you'd think it would be a cautionary tale and a lesson. But again, you know, people forget they don't think about it. They don't know that the electricity rates through Bonneville Power are partly nuclear from the Columbia Generating Station. They don't know that the Columbia Generating Station is on a fault line that could have catastrophic consequences if there's an earthquake. And there has been a lot of resistance to shutting it down because of how persuadable people are that they need that energy for baseload. And yet, it's the only one operating. It's operating at Hanford, which is a terrible place to be. And there's also an X-Energy proposal that's going to be sited at Hanford if it's successful. And so, again, we see this resurgence of funding through the Oregon Department of Energy and through people who have lots of money to spend and aren't going to take on the risks and the degradation that comes along with it.
Well, I want to get back to WPS for a second, because actually the reason why it was such a financial disaster was the fact that only one nuclear power plant actually went into operation. There's another one that got built that's mothballed at Hanford. And then there's sort of hulks that were the very beginnings of construction at a couple other sites.
Right.
But most of them didn't even open.
That's true.
And so that's why there was all this financial hardship as a result of it.
Right, exactly.
And how does that affect the ratepayers?
Well, there was an attempt to keep those funds, I believe, from being charged to the ratepayers, but apparently through several court cases, where it ended up falling is that they can charge ratepayers interest on the bonds that were defaulted on. So we're still paying. And we're paying not just in funds, but the steam generators that were filled with concrete and shipped up the Columbia are out at Hanford. They're radioactive. They're buried. But they're still a risk for that region and for the people who rely on the Columbia River and our native people who use that area for their food and for their fishing and for their living. And so there are lots of ways that we're still paying for something that is so harmful.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Chutty, who's with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation, about how to counter the latest drive to restart the nuclear power engine. Well, this cuts to another big concern about nuclear power, which is what to do with all the waste. And I don't know that we really clarified in the beginning about the ballot initiative in Oregon that passed in 1980 that prohibited the construction of any new nuclear power facilities. And until, and what was the big until?
Until there was a, there is an operating federal waste depository.
And
national.
That was back in the day, back in 1980, they were proposing it for Hanford. I actually took a tour of the place that they were thinking of back in 1982, and it was a terrible site. It had all kinds of geological issues besides, among other things, being on an earthquake fault. And so then they thought of salt mines in New Mexico, and then mm-hmm. it was Yucca Mountain in mm-hmm. Nevada. What state are we at now with this so-called federal nuclear waste repository?
Well, sadly, there's a shift to locating interim sites to move the waste to. But the problem with that is that they're already in interim sites. And when you think about our crumbling infrastructure, the roads and the rail issues, to think about taking those casks from the Columbia,
from Trojan,
and putting them however they would transport them to, say, Texas or I think New Mexico, which is where these interim sites are. There's such tremendous risk with that. And so if they were to, I think there are a lot of barriers to that happening. So I think one of the issues that the quote nuclear renaissance unquote faces is that we have this legacy of waste all over the country. And it's, and if you're going to buy into a new facility that's unproven, untested, and quite uneconomic, the other issue you have to recognize is you're going to be in a storage site for that waste. And these small modular reactors are no different in terms of the amounts of, for most of them anyway, the amounts of waste that they're going to generate, that highly toxic radioactive substance that is going to be on site wherever they're located. So that's not a problem that's been solved, even though every time there's a proposal, the persuasion of the marketing is, well, we're on our way to solving that. And the latest iteration of that is, well, we have these interim sites. But when you think about whether or not that's practical and whether people will risk that, they did a survey in 2020 on a national level to find out where people were at. And actually, more people in this country don't want nuclear power than want it. And the biggest issue they have is the waste, and they don't want it anywhere near. And that's fairly universal. I don't think there's anybody that you could talk to that would say, oh, hey, put that nuclear power plant near me and I'll live with the waste.
Okay, now you mentioned these small modular nuclear power
yes.
plants. So we haven't gotten into what they are. Now let's first of all sort of talk about the old school nuclear power plants like Trojan was or like Fukushima. And how would you compare that to this new generation of nuclear power plants is being touted as safe and small? And
well, they're not exactly, I mean, most of them have already been tried in one way or another.
You're talking about the small modular ones?
Yeah, they're being repackaged, the technology of them, and being sold as if they're smaller, they're safer. Taking the NuScale one,
we need to do a little bit of like letting people know who we're talking about. So who was NuScale?
So NuScale is a company that was founded in 2007 with technology that's been developed at Oregon State University. And it is a proposed reactor that would be sited in Idaho. And the coalition of utilities that are most involved with it, they've renamed themselves the Carbon Free Power Project, CFPP. And NuScale is selling subscriptions to utilities to buy into it. And one of the interesting things is that they have off-ramps along the road for utilities to drop out or withdraw. And enough of them have withdrawn from when it was first being marketed that they've cut the proposal in half, and it's half of the number of modules. So it's putting these modules together and saying they're small because each module can be manufactured, and if you only have one or two, you can site them rurally. I mean, it's kind of a promotion of something that isn't up and running. They don't know if the initial proposed facility is actually going to operate safely. So, but they're still marketing it as this is something that we're going to be able to take to rural areas and be able to make electricity affordable and in areas where it can't normally be located. I'm part of a group that's called Opposing Nuclear Power in the West, and it has 7 or 8 states that are really concerned about proposals that have been popping up. And so the Utah proposal gets a lot of play because the NuScale facility in Idaho is what they're involved with. And I believe some of their congressional delegation went to the Idaho site to do a tour. They went on a field trip, and NuScale didn't show up, but the people who were there and talked to them said, well, remember, this is experimental, and it's probably not going to come online for another decade, which is one of the issues, is the timeline is a huge issue. This is being presented and marketed as something that will help us with climate change.
That's the problem we have right now.
And the problem we have right now. And we have 2030 as the window to really use the things that are available, renewables, storage. All of the billions of dollars that taxpayers are putting into this, and they don't really know it. It's our representatives who are okaying this. And so the NuScale proposal has had billions of dollars already funding it, and yet it's something that isn't going to be around the corner. It's not going to come on in time, and it's most likely it would have to operate for a certain length of time, quite long actually, to prove that it's safe enough to disconnect those modules and take them individually someplace.
What's the difference in size between each individual module and a traditional nuclear power plant?
You know, I'm not a technical person, so I understand that instead of this big, huge one, you know, the generators or whatever, it's in sections, and those each section produces a certain amount of energy, and by putting them together, but saying they're individual, the proponents have been able to get away with saying they will be safe because they're smaller and they're less, you know, they have less risk.
Less radioactivity in them.
So. Yeah. But when you put them all together in a segment, like there's 6 of them, they're still going to generate waste, and they're going to have that collective risk. It doesn't mean that they're not going to have safety problems. It doesn't mean that people operating them are not going to make mistakes that could lead to something quite dangerous and
so
harmful.
When you put all 6 together, is it basically the same size as a standard nuclear power plant then?
I'm not. Okay. Yeah, the scale on it for me, I there's a lot of information out there about it, but I can't speak to that.
Because I got the impression that actually they don't operate individually as separate modules. I mean, that's one of the delusions that the industry puts out. And that when they're all together, the amount of waste that they produce is going to be pretty much comparable to the amount of waste that a standard nuclear power plant would make.
Correct. And I think that's what is currently being proposed. But then I think part of the romance of it, part of the siren call of it, is saying, hey, if we can do this, and it part of it is that you can manufacture the components, and it's not like you have to put up one big thing that can, you know, they try to say that there aren't going to be delays because of that. But I think that part of their marketing is selling it as something they can take in a broken down stage where it's not all 12 modules or all 6 modules, depending on the energy needs of the place that they would be located.
Now, I'm also kind of curious, you say that they would be siting these in rural areas. I can think of a lot of nuclear power plants that are in rural areas, like Trojan, and for that matter, Hanford is pretty rural. Mm-hmm. So what difference does it make? Why would these be more adaptable to rural areas when we already have a lot of nuclear power plants sited in rural areas?
Well, I think we have some, but they're also talking about, I mean, NuScale's out there selling itself in other countries that don't necessarily have big nuclear power plants.
Well, I'm going to talk about this company, NuScale, which I only learned about a year ago. And it's actually an Oregon-based company, right?
Yes.
It's funny that an Oregon-based company be trying to build nuclear power plants in a state which has banned any nuclear power plant construction for the foreseeable future.
That's true. It's, well, I think they're frustrated that they can't get around the ballot measure that turned into a law that's protected us for four decades. They have been in the last four long legislative sessions, NuScale, doing their dog and pony show, showing up and saying, you know what, we have this technology that's homegrown. It's right in our state, and we're getting lots of government money to help us. But we have this pesky little law that gets in the way. So they've actually attempted to either overturn the law or to get themselves exempted on the basis that they're not that those big old bad nuclear power plants that people were worried about when they passed the measure back in 1980. I think they're counting on that people don't, it's not on their radar what the risks are, and people are concerned about having enough energy and having it be something that doesn't have the carbon the way they sell themselves is that it's not emitting. And so there's actually two Pacific Northwest laws that got passed in the last 3 years that are really concerning and opened the door to this, which is in Washington, the Clean Energy Transformation Act was putting in place for Washington what would be clean energy, carbon neutral, heading us into a clean energy economy. And so at the time, those of us who were concerned about nuclear power went and attempted to get the legislators to exclude nuclear energy as one of the sources of either renewable, well, the way they wrote it into the law is it could be renewable or non-emitting. And their non-emitting is really quite diluting, because if it doesn't generate at the site, it still has a huge carbon-intensive fuel cycle that is problematic. But the law got passed, and we were assured that, nuclear power isn't going to happen in Washington at the time. So that was the Washington law in 2019. And then in 2021, in the legislature, there's the Clean Electricity Bill that got passed. And again,
wait, is this in Oregon or Washington?
In Oregon. Yeah. Those of us who were really concerned, and particularly me, who had it on my radar because of what happened in Washington, we showed up and we attempted to get the nuclear energy piece eliminated, excluded, but because I think they want to pass the bill and they don't want to end up with controversy and getting a clean electricity bill through, so that again they resorted to non-emitting as an acceptable alternative. So based on those two laws in Washington and Oregon, nuclear energy passes the test because it's considered non-emitting at the source.
Now I'm kind of curious, because on the one hand, okay, they can say that nuclear power is non-emitting, and I guess that's technically true.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this other law on the books which says no nukes until there is a permanent federal repository.
Correct.
For the waste. So wouldn't that trump this new law?
It does for being built in Oregon. It doesn't for where you get your electricity from. So Pacific Power can put into its resource plan for longer range a nuclear energy from Wyoming. It's not going to be sited in Oregon physically, and it doesn't have to wait for a repository because that's an Oregon restriction. And the sad part of the statute is that it's it can be overturned. And that's what NuScale has been attempting to do four long sessions in a row. And we can expect this next legislative session for them to do the same.
I remember there was a lot of concern about it happening this last legislative session.
Yes.
And it didn't happen. And it seemed like I talked to several people about how I learned that this has been ongoing for a number of years now, that they've been trying to overturn the law against building new nukes in Oregon. And it sounded like there's not a lot of support in the legislature for it.
Well, legislatures can change. It depends on who our representatives are. And, you know, it's nice to know that right now that's the case, but we can't predict that in 2 years it's going to be the same set of legislators who are going to make that same decision. And again, that persuasive power of the nuclear industry and its propaganda, frankly, about what the benefits are versus what the costs are.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Chetty with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation about how to counter the latest drive to restart the nuclear power engine. Well, in the last part of the show, I want to talk about Hanford, which is like the giant elephant in the region in terms of the dangers of nuclear power. And I think going back to the history of how Hanford was the first place being proposed as the national repository for spent fuel rods and nuclear waste.
Yes.
And it's also an incredible example of just what the consequences of having all this waste there. And just as a little sideline, I was at a conference of environmental journalists a number of years ago at Stanford, and there were several discussions during the conference about nuclear power, whether or not it was really a green energy. And I was having a luncheon roundtable, and one of the people at the roundtable was the head of the environmental journalism department at Stanford, and she was talking about how she just listened to these people presenting why nuclear power was such an important part of the portfolio for having renewable energy in the future. And I looked at her, I said, well, what about the waste issue? How can you separate that from all the other concerns? And that's one of the real dangers of nuclear power. And she's looking at me like, well, I said, well, like Hanford, like, you know, I live downstream from Hanford. She says, what's Hanford? Is that the same as Three Mile Island?
Mm.
And I thought, this person is teaching, she's the head of the Department of Environmental Journalism, and she doesn't know what Hanford is. So my first question is, how do we get people to really appreciate what Hanford is and why that is like really the poster child of the dangers of the nuclear power industry?
Well, I think that we have to continue doing what we're doing, which is educating people, letting them know. Your show is a good example of that. It matters to you. You've been involved in this for decades, and you know what the risks and the dangers are. And I know that you did a show back in, I think it was January, February, with Lauren Goldstein about the X-Energy proposal at Hanford. And people have to hear what the harms are. And certainly the harms that exist at Hanford are unique in this country as far as what's there and what needs to be cleaned up. And so, you know, we have to speak up. We have to continue letting people know, and we have to let them know on two fronts. One, what the harms are, and Hanford is the poster child, as you say, and also why, in terms of our just what we share and how we live, that we have to begin to live differently for everyone. And certainly the Columbia River is something that is precious to the indigenous people and also to the tribes who've fished there and lived there and gather food there. And everything else should be secondary to that. And young people have to be reached on it. Kathy Sampson Cruz, who is with the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians, was part of a panel that we did at the law conference. And she read her testimony to her grandson. Essentially, she was talking about what Hanford means, what the risks are with nuclear power. And he's a sophomore in high school, and he said, Grandma, I would never I would never choose nuclear power. But, you know, he is connected with someone who is at the forefront of protecting what, as a grandmother, she wants for her children and everyone else around her. She's on the board of the Columbia River Keeper, and so protection of the river and protection of our state have been really important to her. She and the affiliated tribes were major testifiers at the 2019 legislative session, where they passed a resolution that they oppose all nuclear power in Oregon. And sadly, Hanford is now entertaining that through Washington, and both states are on the brink of moving forward. And we just have to stay vigilant. We have to speak up. We have to monitor what's going on in the legislatures of both states and potentially elect people that see it differently and recognize where the harms are, and also educate our young people. Our young people are out on the forefront about fossil fuels, and they also need to pay attention to the risks with nuclear power. And that's actually one of the things that we have a local group, the Stop Nuclear Working Group, and that came out of a group of people that have been attempting to do the resistance around fossil fuels. And we said, wait a minute, several of us, there's this other risk that we also need to begin to have our young people pay attention to. So,
well, I've had these conversations with Dan Sears where we mostly have talked about fossil fuel over the last 8 years, however long we've been talking a lot to each other. But he also is been Columbia River Keeper's point person on Hanford. And one time when we were talking, we both acknowledged that Hanford actually keeps us up at night even more so
yes.
than the fossil fuel industry. So let's talk a little bit about why Hanford is keeping Dan and me up, and I'm sure keeping you up as well.
Well, because it is for our region, it has so much risk for anything so harmful to be located there. And
what's located there?
Well, it's actually one of the atomic weapons sites from 1945. So as Kathy said, Kathy Sampson Cruz, when she was talking to the law conference, she said it's been 77 years, and the harms that came to all of the tribes that are located, and some of them in the region of Hanford, are in all the tribes that are affected by uranium mining. It's not like Hanford is done, and it's got tremendous amount of cleanup that still needs to be done. And one of the reasons that nuclear energy is such a dirty distraction is that the billions of dollars that are going federally to it are ones that could be used for that cleanup and for making that area safe. And here we have what's already greatly harming Hanford and that region, and now at the prospect of adding to it instead of ensuring that the harm that was done there is removed. It can't be totally removed, but is remediated and we're protected from adding any more.
Well, there is a strange attitude amongst I think European cultures, that includes the United States, because we're heavily influenced by European culture, that you can destroy parts of the planet for a greater good, whatever that greater good would be. And I think, I guess, with Hanford, the greater good was winning World War II. And so this vast area, I don't remember how many acres, that's just highly contaminated. And that I guess I won't say there's been no serious effort to clean it up, because there certainly has some progress has been made in the last. I've been going out there since 1982, and there's a lot further along on the cleanup now than it was 40 years ago. But there seems to me that there's still not a serious effort to really address the seriousness of the high-level contamination that's there, and the fact that there's been the Trump administration was going to just try to reclassify high-level waste as low-level waste and not worry about it, and the Biden administration's not doing much better. So I wonder how we put pressure to name what's going on there, and how that naming can maybe spread out to name and shame the nuclear power industry for what it really is.
Well, I think that, again, it's a matter of letting people know. And we tend to lull ourselves into, well, there's a Democratic administration now, so things are going to be better. But notice what you just said. The Biden administration is not doing anything differently, and that reclassification of the waste, where that's the idea of that being generated from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to be the regulatory body that oversees, and instead they are really co-opted by the industry. And just as an example, and I'm going to throw it in at the end, and it's not Hanford, but it's a good example of how the NRC's reach is a problem. Lake Barrett, the overseer at Three Mile Island, he is now he's a consultant with the Japanese government and TEPCO for dumping all of that radioactive, highly radioactive water into our ocean and our marine life. And this is a Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulator. And so at Hanford, we can't trust that the decisions that are being made by the government, by either the federal government or even Washington, are going to make the right choices there. They're going to try to make it all go away. And they're using the catastrophic climate change awareness as a smokescreen or a cover to get people to forget how terrible that legacy is and what needs to happen to it. And we just have to keep speaking the truth and coming back over and over again to say, wait a minute. I mean, the truth is our best weapon. And the other thing is that they have a lot of money, but we have people and the ability to organize people around the truth and to help elect people who make decisions as though people mattered and not as though it's industry and business that matters.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining us on Wilkes Focus today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Catherine Chetty with the Oregon Conservancy Foundation, and you've been listening to Wilkes Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all its volunteers make the best radio possible from home during the pandemic. Though I'm here live in the station today, we'll say, and that's really a pleasure. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I also want to mention that Extinction Rebellion PDX is sponsoring Bloom Not Doom, a protest against Zenith Energy's continued operation. On June 4th at noon, they will gather at the corner of Northwest St. Helens Road and Kittredge Street, which is right, there's a bridge that takes you over to the port area. And they'll be gathering at noon and march across the bridge to Zenith. For more information or parking or other details, or to let them know you're coming, email info@xrpdx.org. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with John Osuninski with Multnomah County about the dangers of the CEI hub in the Portland Harbor. We'll go with music by Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask. Up to heaven.